www.traffictickets.com today.
Are you tired of police, judges, and bureaucrats using traffic tickets and other regulatory traps to trick you out of your hard-earned money? Are you sick of fraudulent bankers rigging mortgages and using the foreclosure process to steal your home? You need to visit bestfreedomtools.com. Act now to get an amazing free catalog and free DVD packed with vital information to give you the upper hand against these so-called authorities. You will learn how to overcome all traffic fines, how to stop judges in their tracks, and how to effectively combat penalty notices of all kinds without paying a penny. All the information you need to regain your health, wealth, and power is yours at bestfreedomtools.com. To get your free catalog and free DVD, call 800-880-9976. That's 800-880-9976. Or visit bestfreedomtools.com now for your free catalog and free DVD. bestfreedomtools.com, giving you the information you need today.
Welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Totley speaking from Washington, D.C., and this is the last program of the old year. We're recording our program here on New Year's Eve. It is December 31st, 2010, and given the change of the years, we want to stress even more than usual the world historical tendencies that are shaping the present world economic depression as we descend further into depression. Now, we're going through a kind of a phase change. The reactionary Republicans will be arriving in Washington, D.C. next week, and they will also be arriving in governors' mansions and state legislatures across the United States. And you can get set for an orgy of Dickensian cruelty, the immorality of primitive accumulation, of brazen looting and asset stripping is now upon us. A tribe of ogres, if you will, a tribe of ultra-reactionaries, proto-fascists in quite a few cases, people whose cruelty, whose cynicism, duplicity knows no bounds, opinionated petty bourgeois ideologues, fanatics in the service of big, very big finance capital. The gapocalypse, apocalypse now, the gopocalypse, the GOP apocalypse is now upon us. We've seen the plague of Obama. We've been through 2 years of Obama the Wall Street puppet, Obama the warmonger, Obama the union buster, Obama the totalitarian, and so forth. But we are now caught between two terrible threats. On the one hand, the Obama one that we've been living through, but now the new phase. And this one promises to be more abortive, more apocalyptic. And I'm not pulling words out of the air. I'm quoting the distinguished ultra-reactionary senator from Oklahoma, Coburn, now sporting a beard. Maybe he can't face himself in the mirror every morning, so he's got to disguise himself in his own shaving mirror. He says that we now face apocalyptic spending cuts. Apocalyptic spending cuts. And we've heard from this Betsy McCoy, written McCaukey, the arch harpy of the anti-healthcare pro-insurance company lobbyists, who has been on the radio boasting that the new Republicans are going to starve the beast of Obamacare. Well, that sounds okay. We don't need Obamacare. But what she means by that is starve the beast means to strip away the health care of the American people through Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, also by removing whatever positive limitations on the power of insurance companies were included as window dressing in this catastrophic Obama healthcare reform. So apocalyptic spending cuts, time to starve the beast. A tribe of petty bourgeois fanatics who are now at the gates here in Washington, and a bunch of plutocrat governors will be highlighting the case of Florida and Rick Scott, the experienced asset stripper from Hospital Corporation of America. The depression, therefore, about to get much worse, and we could be facing something like the default of the United States of America in March. That would be an act of high treason. Let's get it on the scoreboard right away. You vote to make the United States default. You're part of a conspiracy to do that. That's high treason, and that's an overt act. So be warned. The depression now getting much worse. The Wall Street Journal this morning says that Borders Books may be about to blow. Borders Books has stopped paying publishers for those of us who write books, a heavy blow. Here's the immediate economic picture. I think it's very grim. The gasoline price in many localities has now gone above $3 a gallon, and we've got hedge fund hyenas and asset strippers on the radio eagerly predicting that this will go to $4 and $5 a gallon. And we will devote a segment to this secret derivatives committee, the secret committee of, I guess it's 11 zombie bankers who are meeting in secret. Sorry, nine zombie bankers. It's a secret cartel created more or less within the framework of Dodd-Frank, although there is some kind of friction on this, but essentially this is what it is. The ICE Trust and the other company, Market, M-A-R-K-I-T, described by the New York Times as organizing a secret committee of derivatives. And what we'll be doing later on in the show is to plug in the fact that the price of gasoline on the basis of pure speculation using derivatives has gone above $3 a gallon, headed for $4, and headed indeed beyond that. This is the handiwork of that committee. It's got to be linked. Plug in the gas price to the existence of the secret committee of the nine oligarchs, and you have got the picture of how you will be looted and flayed alive during 2011. So gas over $3, headed for $4. Oil over $90. We've got a tremendous commodity price inflation. It has nothing to do with underlying economic activity. It is pure speculation, pure derivatives speculation. We're therefore looking at endless depression. The other really bad news of the past week has been the Case-Shiller Housing Index. According to the Wall Street Journal of the 29th of December, housing prices in the United States fell by 1.3% in 20 major U.S. housing markets, down 1.3% in 3 months. And therefore, according to many consultants, the housing double dip is here. Housing double dip is now a reality. That means, obviously, a double dip recession in their terms simply means that the depression, as we see it, the world economic depression that we've been in since 2007-2008, this continues and is indeed accelerating in many ways. We've also got the stock market. They point to the stock market. The stock market is ending the year up. Well, yes, thanks to Barky Obama's tax sellout to the rich and super rich, and thanks to his to helicopter Ben Bernanke's QE2 flooding of the financial markets with hot paper dollars. Therefore, there is some money sloshing around, enough to go into the New York stock market and drive it up in the second half of the year. We're also told that unemployment claims for the last week in December have declined. Well, this, of course, is simply that it was it's not the last week. It's the week before Christmas. That is because on Christmas Eve, a lot of these places were closed, right? A lot of the state unemployment offices closed on Christmas Eve. So instead of having a five-day week to put in your unemployment claims, it became a four-day week to put them in. So it's a depression. Just as a sidelight, people are expecting a hecatomb of oligarchs and plutocrats on the 30th and 31st, between yesterday and today, as their greedy heirs decide that they'd rather have the estate proceed under the law of 2010 rather than waiting for 2011. So there are a lot of plugs being pulled and a lot of hospitals and a lot of sick old oligarchs as their greedy heirs decide, after consulting with their tax accountants, that it's better to have the estate go in during 2010 than 2011, given even under Barkey's new sellout. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, calling your attention as always to Tarpley.net. You ought to catch up on that story of December 23rd, 1310, with Dante's candidate for Holy Roman Emperor and for sovereign of northern Italy arriving in Milan and setting up the Visconti dynasty, which then, several decades later, went on to produce the first prototype of the modern state, and many other recent interviews on the Obama birth certificate issue, interviews on WikiLeaks and Assange and the latest CIA limited hangout operations, all of that to be found at Tarpley.net. So here we are. We're on the eve of the Gopocalypse. A gang of ogres are coming to town, right? These Vikings that you see in the Capital One commercials would be a useful comparison, except it's much more sinister. So they're coming to town. Now, we look back at 2010. What can we say about the progress of the Depression? It is the year the Depression came to Europe. Let's just recall the basic framework of comparison that we have is to compare the current world economic depression, breakdown crisis, and disintegration of the imperialist world order with what you had in 1929 to 1931. And in those days, remember, we had the New York stock market crash of October 1929, and then a period of 1 to 1.5 years of relatively less apocalyptic activity, less crash. But then in the spring of 1931, we had the Austrian banking crisis, soon followed by the entire Central and Eastern European banking crisis. Highlight of that was the collapse of the German banking system in June and July of 1931, and that then turned into the collapse of the Dutch banks and then the collapse of the British pound, the bankruptcy of the British pound sterling, default on gold payment by the Bank of England, September 21st, 1931. And remember, that's the central event of the world economic depression of those days. That's what destroyed world trade, not Holy Smoot, because this is what destroyed the only world currency system that there was. Now, after 1931, that was the second phase, the collapse of Europe, the second phase. The third phase then became a banking panic inside the United States, which took up the whole year of 1932 into 1933, such that on the eve of Franklin D. Roosevelt's inauguration, every bank had shut down. He didn't shut down any of them. They were already shut down. The free market, so to speak, had shut them down, and nobody had succeeded in opening them up. So he was basically giving them legal cover with the bank holiday. So three waves, right? The immediate stock market panic, then the European banking crash, and then coming back to the United States in the form of a banking panic. So let's look at what we had. In September and October of 2008, we had the New York banking panic, a run on the zombie banks. Obviously, all of them bankrupt. The cases of Lehman Brothers, AIG, and Merrill Lynch. but really all of them, be it J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, all the rest of them, thoroughly bankrupt. Bankrupted by what? Well, generally by credit default swaps in the case of AIG, but of collateralized debt obligations in the case of most of the others, based at several removes on, in some cases, on subprime, but also on auto loans and credit card loans and so forth. So we are following, in a general way, there's a rough parallel between what happened in 29 to 31 and what we've seen now over the last almost 2.5 years. So remember, in 2009, we had helicopter Ben Bernanke flooding the dollar system with plenty of cheap credit, right, liquidity injections, to the tune of an open credit line of $24 trillion in theory, and as they now claim, $3.3 trillion actually lent out to various zombie institutions. And remember, you had to be a financial parasite in order to qualify. If you produced anything, you were immediately disqualified. So the whole system, the reverse of what it ought to be in reality. As a result of the $24 trillion line of credit open and $3.3 trillion actually lent out, the dollar tended to fall all during 2009. And by August, September 2009, you can look on my website, you can see a commentary I did for Russia Today in August of 2009 that the dollar was in danger of some kind of a very, very sickening downward lurch, with the possibility then of hyperinflation. Remember, hyperinflation is a foreign exchange event, and it's often caused by economic warfare. Then in November 2009, we had this Dubai crisis around the time of Thanksgiving. And this began to turn the situation around. That is, after the contagion, so to speak, had hit Dubai, it then turned back towards Europe. And the dollar hit its 2009 low around December 1st, give or take a couple of weeks, perhaps. After that, the dollar began to strengthen precisely on the rumors that a sovereign debt crisis was coming to Europe. In other words, the European countries, which had gone very, very far down the road to bail out the zombie banks of that continent and the derivatives mongers of that continent, they were also then groaning under the increased social expenditure of more unemployed, more need for social services as the depression hit. And we had in February 2010 that infamous idea dinner. Again, read about it at tarpley.net, all written up. The idea dinner reported by the Wall Street Journal at Moness, Crespi, and Hart, where we had leading hedge fund hyenas from the U.S. side, including the Soros interests, getting together to figure out how can you attack the euro? Well, you can't do it directly. You got to do it through some weak flanks and some chinks in the armor, and that would be the Greek government bond market, the Spanish, Portuguese, some other government bond market. So this then became the big theme of the springtime, was a speculative attack on the euro, engineered, of course, for money in the narrow sense, but also from a strategic point of view, in order to shift the crisis from the dollar over to the euro. Beggar my neighbor, export the depression, competitive devaluation of the dollar. And that campaign that began in the very early days of 2010 or end of 2009 peaked around May, June, with the low point of the euro being reached at that point. Now, remember, this is also the flash crash. My thesis is that the flash crash of May 6th is not what various SEC and CFTC say it was, but rather was a figment. It was a boomerang effect of an attack on the euro. If you look at that flash crash day, not only did the Dow go down by 1,000 points in about 10 minutes, quite breathtaking if you live through it, as I was interested enough to do. But the euro was crashing down against the yen markedly. So what they found was they could crash the euro, but they'd be crashing New York at the same time, and that wouldn't really serve their purpose. So they relented, and that's the story of May 6th. We'll continue this retrospective in just a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
The World Crisis Radio, our year ender here, December 31st, 2010. So just reviewing the financial crash history, the unfolding of the breakdown crisis, 2008, 2009, 2010. May 6th, the flash crash, an attack on the euro that boomeranged. There was a blowback effect against the New York market, so they had to relent. And that put the Anglo-Americans into disarray. Also the fact that China was taking advantage of the attack on the euro to buy up places like Greece and some others at bargain basement prices. But that, of course, created demand for euros. The Anglo-Americans, very, very unhappy, right? We're thinking of Admiral Beatty at Jutland in 1916 after three of his most modern battle cruisers had blown up in the first 15 minutes, right? What's wrong with our bloody ships today? Well, back in May, June, the Anglo-Americans were saying, what's wrong with our bloody financial warfare this year? And it didn't work. It didn't work immediately. They haven't given up. They've continued, right? They've been, it's like, you know, the campaigns along the Isonzo in World War One. There were, I think, 12 or 13 offensives. The Anglo-Americans keep pounding away at the euro, but it didn't work in the sense that they had planned, which was a panic flight out of the euro in May and June, meaning that central banks all over the world would panic dump whatever euros they had, and the dollar would be the beneficiary, break up the euro and go in there and then cannibalize what was left. That did not happen. So all during it took a month or two for things to settle down after that, but by July, you had the dollar getting weaker and the euro getting stronger again. And this created problems of its own, meaning that as the dollar goes down, the Chinese renminbi, the Chinese people's dollar, the yuan, also goes down. And that means Chinese exports become cheaper and cheaper, undercutting everybody else, undercutting South Korea and Malaysia and Thailand and everybody, Brazil, on the world market. So this then began to create a backlash. And the backlash emerged at the IMF meeting in November, where we had the Brazilian finance minister mocking Helicopter Ben, saying throwing dollar bills out of a helicopter is not an acceptable strategy. And you had a tendency then in November for at least limited measures of economic self-defense, limited forms of exchange controls and capital controls coming on in. We should also remember that back in May, after the flash crash, Finance Minister Stoibla of Germany had taken the lead in banning naked credit default swaps on German government bonds denominated in euros and also other euro government denominated bonds, and had been followed to some extent by South Korea. At the same time, some restrictions on derivatives in South Korea back in May to June. Now, Geithner had, of course, freaked out about that, but Stoibler was hanging tough. So those have generally stood, but they have not been followed by the rest of Europe. Europe has failed in general, and this is the tragedy of the euro, that the European Union has failed to do anything systematic to fight speculation, to ban credit default swaps, to impose a Tobin tax on other derivatives, probably to ban collateralized debt obligations as well, to completely ban all short sales, in particular naked shorts, and so forth. Not done, and that's why the crisis still goes on, and indeed that's what happened. By October, November, it was clear that Ireland was the next candidate after Greece. Greece had gotten about a $100 billion bailout in May, June. European Union had created a $1 trillion fund back in June. Ireland then became the second country to succumb. In October, they had to take a bailout. They also had to come under International Monetary Fund conditionality. You give up your own sovereignty, you become a vassal and an occupied country of the international bankers through the IMF. There are no success stories for the IMF. Once you're under this, you're going to be in a worse and worse crisis. So the at the same time, though, there was a movement, and this is written up in the Wall Street Journal this past week. If you look at the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, December 28th, as crisis sweeps Ireland, Europe lurches across the Rubicon. This is the Deauville meeting. Deauville, of course, the French resort. I think it's spelled D-O-U-G-H-V-I-L-L-E, a good place to talk about monetary reform. So here we have Merkel and Sarkozy, two unfortunate types, despite a couple of interesting things from them in the past year. Merkel wants to make the bondholders feel the pain, and Sarkozy, needing some cover for his reelection run, goes along with it. So they've done something halfway positive. Unfortunately, it's a half measure. It's enough to get the bankers angry at you and to make them attack you, but it's not enough to shut them down. So the idea is that if you say any European country that defaults in the future, the bankers are going to take a haircut on their bonds. They're going to feel the pain, too, not just the taxpayers. In theory, that's okay, right? That makes sense. It's equitable. But in practice, that means that they're going to dump your bonds and they're going to try to overthrow you politically. And that's the problem of some oligarchical congeries led by a committee of bureaucrats without a strong executive, right? That's what you would need. It would be a European executive. And I don't mean Van Rompuy, the broken man chosen because he's such a little bureaucratic mouse, but somebody with some guts, right? Some chutzpah, fegataccio. No, they don't have that in Brussels. So what happens then is this this causes a big split inside the European Union, as we learn in this interesting article. Merkel and Sarkozy meeting at Deauville call into Luxembourg, where the bankers are meeting, and tell Trichet of the European Central Bank, we're going to write in this default clause. What happens if one of our countries defaults? And Trichet hits the ceiling, you're going to destroy the euro. So he freaks out because I've been telling them that no country in Europe will ever, ever, ever be allowed to default. Sarkozy says to Trichet, maybe you're talking to bankers. We're responsible to citizens. The essential tension of the modern state. Is it a creature of the bankers or of the citizens? We're told that now in the European negotiations, the obligations of zombie banks are considered to be the obligations of the country. I read you that quote a couple of weeks ago. We're also given the interesting story that when the Irish government comes out with its austerity plan to reassure the worried markets, mythological, childish fairy tale language when you're dealing with hedge fund wolves and predators on the attack. These are worried investors. No, they're not. They're hedge fund wolf packs looking for prey. When Lenihan, the incompetent Irish finance minister, gets on a conference call with hundreds of investors to try to tout his austerity plan, he's drowned out by a deluge of catcalls and derision, people heckling him and shouting, "Short Ireland, short Ireland, short Ireland." Well, you short the modern state, boys, and you should get it in the chops, meaning there should be a short squeeze on you, a Tobin tax on you, an antitrust investigation on you, and other things to reassert normal civilization and legality. But, of course, not in the European Union. Therefore, this goes on. In August, Helicopter Ben at Jackson Hole had talked about the QE2 flooding of another trillion into the markets, and that's then what he did, leading to all of this tension in October and November. Just before Christmas, the European Union met and agreed that they would set up not a temporary and really illegal bailout fund, but they would now go ahead and change the Treaty of Lisbon and they would institute a permanent bailout fund. So we're just waiting for the next round, the next wave of crisis to hit the euro as the dollar goes down. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
on air, online, and on demand. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, continuing, hopefully completing our review of 2010 in terms of the breakdown crisis and the depression in response to this really speculator-induced crisis. This is a cynical, conspiratorial attack by hedge fund hyenas meeting in places like Moness, Crespi, and Hart with the presence of Soros and others, attacking the euro through the obvious weak points, the Greeks, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Irish. Maybe the Belgians and the Italians come next. Instead, the response, instead of shutting down the speculators or putting a short squeeze on them and wiping them out and banning them, has been to propitiate them with austerity programs. The austerity programs have caused a degree of social chaos, but now at the end of the year, we'd have to say the whole European protest movement against austerity is a failure. And it's a failure not because you didn't have mass forces. You did have mass forces, but through the lack of programmatic ideas. And we stress programmatic ideas because that's what we're offering on this radio program. We deal in programmatic ideas, the one missing ingredient that these huge European parties and unions didn't have, didn't want to have, but didn't have certainly, has made them a failure. Nobody has been ousted, not one serious austerity plan has been rolled back. Look, the French, they put up a good show, but Prime Minister Fillon, the usual thing in the French Fifth Republic is if the regime gets in trouble, the Prime Minister is ousted. It's happened dozens of times. Fillon is still there. He's not out. How about Papandreou of Greece? He's still there, a socialist. Socrates, in Portugal, so-called socialist, he's still there. Zapatero of Spain, still there. The Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, the Fianna Fáil of Ireland, right? The Men of Destiny, they're still there. Stress on the Fáil, huh? And Cameron and Clegg in Britain, despite the affront to Prince Charles and the horsewoman there, they're also still in power. Nobody has been knocked out. All of this Sturm und Drang, and nobody has been rolled back. Nobody has been forced to take it back. So there's a failure. So you got to ask yourself, dear Euro protesters, right? We're full of sympathy for your goals. What is missing is that you've got to have programmatic solutions. You can't just say, we don't want to pay. You've got to say who should pay. Better yet, the Tobin tax. Better still, the seizing of the European Central Bank and 0% credit for production. And if you can do that at the euro level, that's a big step forward. Don't give up on that until you've really tried it. And this fight is just beginning. And of course, ultimately, if you can't do it at the euro level, if it breaks up, then you've got to do it in your own local central bank. So that's one big failure. Now, at the end of the year in December, we've learned that there's this secret committee. The New York Times on the 11th of September writes of a secret derivatives cartel committee with monthly meetings. Now, this is a violation of antitrust law. This is a blatant prima facie violation of Sherman antitrust and Clayton antitrust, plus the securities laws of the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission Act of 1933. Who is in the cartel? It's interesting. Remember, the definition of fascism in economic terms is a government-sponsored compulsory cartel, but that's not enough. It has to have specific goals to lower production, to lower wages, and to deny services, and to prop up derivatives or other speculative paper issued by financier oligarchs. And that's what we have. We have an example of the fascist corporate state, because this operates essentially through the nonfeasance of the Holder and Shapiro and Gansler regimes in the relevant regulatory agencies. So they're setting prices. Who is in it? JP Morgan Chase through Thomas Bennison, Morgan Stanley, with James J. Hill, not the railroad baron, but the derivatives baron. We got Deutsche Bank, good U.S. institution, with Athanasios Diplas. You've got UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, from the Bahnhofstrasse with Paul Hamill. You've got Barclays of London with Paul Mitsotakis. You've got Credit Suisse, also of Zurich, with Andy Hubbard. You've got Goldman Sachs with Oliver Frankel. You've got Bank of America with Ali Balali. Belial? No, Ali Balali. Citigroup with Biswarup Chatterjee. Now, it's interesting. If you have some theory of, that some ethnic group dominates the world, you're going to have to figure this one out, because we got... We could make a case for all kinds of different ethnic conspiracies. I won't take the time, but it simply shows the absurdity of that point of view, the absurdity of looking at things in those terms. And this is all chaired and set up by the ICE Trust. That's the London Intercontinental Exchange, through the ICE Trust and the ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. We're now told it's the powerful, the influential International Swaps and Derivatives Association. And remember, they were lobbying Congress. Yes, indeed. They had a big hand in writing the Dodd-Frank bill through Scott Brown, who drives a truck. He drives a truck for the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, and this is the big bucks. This is such a cartel that we're told Bank of New York Mellon, which was the back office of the TARP bailout, has been excluded. They claim that they've been excluded. And the Citadel Hedge Fund with Ken Griffin, they've also been excluded. And there's a parallel but lesser secret cartel committee at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is also attempting to compete with this, but it's very one-sided. This seems to be the center of the action. And the idea is, when you have a market, you're supposed to have a bid and an ask, which is public. It's got to be publicly stated, either on a screen or through open outcry or whatever it is. But in this case, it's a black box. You're told what, if you ask, you know, how much is an oil future, they'll tell you. What they'll sell it to you for, but they won't tell you the bid and the ask, and the buyer doesn't know what the seller is getting, and the seller doesn't know what the buyer is paying. So this is a complete anti-market conspiracy. Gee, I wonder if the Tea Party, I wonder if all these Tea Party representatives are going to take this up, because this violates the free market, doesn't it? This is a cartel. This is a state-sponsored compulsory cartel for those purposes that qualifies as the fascist corporate state. And of course, don't wait for Holder or any of these others to do anything about it. Now, put that together with the fact that the price of oil is now over $90, the price of gasoline now over $3. This, I think, might be the way that Obama will finally go down, because he's not going to fight this. The people will have to fight it. If you want to stop such a speculative attack, we have been recommending this now since the summer of 2008, you've got to impose 100% margin requirements, that you're not allowed to speculate in the oil market using borrowed money. There have got to be position limits so that a huge zombie bank can't come in and buy up and overwhelm what is essentially a rather restricted market. You've got to have a systematic distinction between end users, people who are actually going to take delivery of the stuff and use it. They qualify as hedgers and speculators. You cannot have naked shorting. You cannot have naked credit default swaps or any other kind of naked derivative. And most obviously is, you've got to impose even the existing antitrust law would shut these people down. The existing antitrust law would have shut down the idea dinner there at Moness, Crespi, and Hart back in February, but the existing Sherman and Clayton antitrust acts would shut down that cartel that we've just talked about. And that means you've got to do that. You've got to enforce the applicable law. You know, we hear all about the rule of law versus illegal immigrants and God knows what. How about right here? This is an issue of some public importance. So you want to stop speculation. That's what it is. And this rise in the oil price is pure speculation. Pure. It's dirty speculation. Call it that. So that is more or less where we are right now as we look for the next lurch into a deeper valley of the depression ahead of us. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, our last program of the old year, recording here on December 31st, 2010. Now let's catch up with Obama, the faker in the White House. He just did a recess appointment. He has appointed a certain James Cole to be the number two in the Justice Department, right? The Deputy Attorney General, number two to Holder. This guy is a former consultant for AIG. He's a finance oligarch, an asset stripper, a Wall Street tool. So don't look for any antitrust or anti-monopoly, anti-derivatives action there. On the medical front, we have Butcher Berwick. That's a previous recess appointment by Obama. Butcher Berwick over at Medicare is now bringing up the death panels again, and the death panels in this case is this end-of-life consultation where they try to bully befuddled old people into signing themselves down the tubes. Also notice that the Food and Drug Administration has banned Avastin, which is a potentially quite effective anti-cancer drug. It's pretty clear that Avastin is being banned because it's too expensive and they don't want to pay. So genocidal austerity brought to you by Hope and Change, Obama. And we could go on, but let's catch up with the direct anti-Obama front on the birth certificate. This, of course, was the week where Chris Matthews on MSNBC said he finally realized that he hadn't seen the real birth certificate, and he thinks Obama should show his real birth certificate. And that caused quite a stir on the right-wing talk show network. So let's get a report from Phil Berg in Philadelphia here on the last day of the year.
How you doing?
Happy New Year, Phil.
Happy New Year to you. I think it's very significant what you just said with going on with Chris Matthews. I think it could be that the powers that be are realizing that Obama is not going to get reelected or he's in trouble. So I think they're turning the tide on him now. With Chris Matthews asking for the birth certificate, I think, in my opinion, is very significant. Also, you had the new governor of Hawaii, Abercrombie, who came out last week making all kinds of statements. He's going to have it released. And then all of a sudden now they shut him up. I think what happened was he are you there with me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what happened was that Abercrombie really believed that Obama was born in Hawaii and he's asking for the release of documents. And then I think the Obama people got to him and said, close your mouth because he really wasn't born here and we don't want the records open. So it's going to be very curious if Abercrombie, what he continues to say from this point on or what he doesn't continue to say. And I think that perhaps our deep throat, which I'm looking for, is going to come out. I think they might get to the point of, hey, we had enough of you, because even though Obama did fine on this appointments, and not the appointments, but some of the legislation he got done at the last minute here, overall, people are not happy with him. He's very low in the polls. He keeps dropping in the polls. And we might see in fruition here what I started back on August 21st, 2008. So I'm looking forward to this. I'm curious what the Republicans will do, because I think Chris Matthews came through from the Democratic side, so it's significant. But on the Republican side, you know, we're going to start pushing, and other people are on Daryl Issa, who has the subpoena power. You know, in my opinion, if he would hold one hearing, one congressional hearing, subpoena records, the ball game would be over for Obama, because I am 1,000% sure that I am completely correct on this, that he is a fraud, a phony. This is the biggest hoax against the United States of America in 234 years. And I guess we're going to 235 years right now. But I think it's significant. And perhaps the new year will give us what I asked for a long, long time ago. And that will mean great things for the people in this country, because when we get him out of office, everything he's done is voidable, so everything will become void. And that's from the health care on down. As I say to many people, my website, which is obamacrimes.com, obamacrimes.com, we are the umbrella for everyone, no matter what your issue is. If your issue is health care, if your issue is the war, if your issue is Social Security, whatever your issue is, it comes under us, because fighting on those other issues will not get him out of office. Fighting on my issue, and that's a significant that he's not constitutionally eligible to be president. Significant, more significant than the birth certificate. People keep going on that, but that could do him in if we can get that exposed, is the fact that even if he was born in Hawaii, when he's adopted in Indonesia, that changes everything. His name became Barry Soetoro, S-O-E-T-O-R-O. If he hasn't legally changed his name since that time, that's his name, Barry Soetoro. They called him Barry in Hawaii. They called him Barry at Occidental College. That's significant, because if he, once you're adopted, the best example is I asked an immigration attorney, what about Obama? He said, no, no. I said, well, what about the children from Haiti that are being adopted? He said, oh, that's easy. They have separated their relationship completely with Haiti, and they take on the new family's last name. I said, well, how is that different than Obama? He couldn't answer, because he's one of these people that a small percentage in this country who still believe in Obama and believe that he's told the truth. But once he's adopted, his name now is Barry Soetoro, and he could have, you know, people say, well, a child can't, the rights can't be taken away. True to a point, but between the ages of 18 and 21, you would have to redo your relationship with you would have to renounce your Indonesia thing. He would have had to, in particular, and regain whatever he had in the United States. But once he had been adopted there, the only thing he could regain would be naturalized, not natural born. And that's the one case I have still pending, which we're getting ready to go to the U.S. Supreme Court on, and that's the fact that I claim that he's not natural born, he's not naturalized, but he's an illegal alien, and therefore he could not have served as a United States Senator from Illinois for the 6 years, or five and a half years, and therefore the salary and benefits he received, which is about $1 million, should be returned to the U.S. Treasury. That case, significant upon that is most of the cases that have been out in the country, and the few that are still left, have all been on the issue of standing, and the courts have knocked down the standing. But on the claim I have, it comes under the False Claims Act, or QUITAM, Q-U-I-T-A-M, and on that, that type case has already been up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they have determined that the person bringing that action, in this case me, has standing. So I've that's the one. Go on my website, obamacrimes.com. Read it. Understand it. The fact is, I'm claiming that there's a conflict of interest with Eric Holder, because Eric Holder, if there was ever a conflict of interest, it's Eric Holder, because he was a senior member of Obama's campaign staff, number one. Number two, he was one of three individuals selected by Obama to select the vice president who selected Biden. And number three, he was nominated and confirmed as the Attorney General of the United States, the largest law, the highest law enforcement officer in the country, who reports to and advises the president. So if that's not a conflict of interest, there's no conflict of interest. And I asked that to the court. They turned me down. And I said, well, either I should handle that prosecution against Obama or appoint a special prosecutor to review the matter. They didn't do either. So I think my feeling is 2011 is going to bring us the results that we've been fighting for since 2008. And if they had done what my first lawsuit stated back on August 21st, 2008, before he was nominated, then we would not be going through this nightmare we've had for the past years.
Yeah.
So my best wishes to you and everyone for a healthy and happy new year.
Why don't we join in urging people that if you have some time over the holiday weekend, Darrell Issa takes over next week as the head of the House Government Operations Committee, and it's easy to shoot him an email saying we expect you, just at the most elementary, simplest level, issue that subpoena. We want to see this birth certificate, if it's there, what Abercrombie said he wanted to reveal or reveal more of, right? It's like a striptease with these people. Anyway, Happy New Year. We'll see you next year.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Okay, welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now let's try to cover some territory here in our final three segments. We've just gone through the Secret Derivatives Committee that meets every month. JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Bank, Union Bank of Switzerland, Barclays, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Citigroup, all under the chairmanship of ICE Trust with the sinister International Swaps and Derivatives Association lurking in the background. That's trust. That's cartel. Violates Sherman antitrust and Clayton antitrust. And of course, Obama does nothing. And Holder, now we've got this new recess appointment, as I just mentioned. James Cole, the number two in the Department of Justice, a consultant for AIG. How about that? He was part of that credit default swaps monstrosity. So you want to stop speculators. We've given the program. Take a look at the five-point program that's displayed at Tarpley.net, in particular the London ICE exchange, escaping even the very weak U.S. regulatory regime, was the main locus of the bidding up of the oil price to $150 during the summer of 2008. And we are headed there again. And let's see who's willing to fight. Let's see if the Tea Party is willing to fight to protect the American people from being raped by these oil speculators. The other thing, of course, the fraud closure crisis, and this goes on. Every week a new enormity. Obama had a chance to make that a political issue before the election. He struck out completely. He entered the fight on the wrong side. He entered the fight on the side of the bankers. Here we have the Wall Street Journal of today, Friday, December 31st, 2010. We have a story of a dead soul, and this is not the wonderful novel by Gogol, the Smertnaya Dushi, but it's a dead soul, a woman who has been dead since 1995, who is nevertheless still active as a robo-signer in implementing illegal fraud closures for Portfolio Recovery Associates in lawsuits against borrowers. She died in 1995, yet her signature later appeared on thousands of affidavits submitted by Portfolio Recovery Associates Incorporated, after Portfolio Recovery Associates were sued for fraud, they decided in early 2008 that any documents bearing the name of the late Martha Kunkel, anything that says Martha Kunkel on it, had defects and should not be used when trying to collect debts. And we even have facsimiles here in the Wall Street Journal. What are we waiting for? Stop fraud closures. Uniform federal law. No fraud closure. No foreclosure on primary residence for 5 years or the duration of the Depression. Fraser-Lemke Act, 1935. Apply it to primary residences. Obama could do this with regulations. Mrs. Warren could do it. My God, we're going to be talking about Mrs. Warren's profession if she doesn't do something soon. A new production of that just opened in Washington, D.C. How ironic. How embarrassing for Professor Warren. They could act under Dodd-Frank. There's got to be something in there. They could certainly act under the Trading with the Enemy Act and the Defense Production Act, given the fact that we have multiple states of emergency going. But no, instead what they're planning to do, this is now going to be the Environmental Protection Agency, they are going to try to drive up the price of oil even higher by implementing their lunatic crackpot carbon theories in the form of regulations. And will anybody fight? We'll be interested to see. So now, Obama. We are told by Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is boasting. This is the Republican leader in the Senate, of course. Mitch McConnell is boasting that the deal he just got for the rich plutocrats on the estate tax is better than what was obtained when the Republicans controlled the White House and both Congress houses. In other words, with George W. Bush in the White House, Hastert the Bastard running the House of Representatives and McConnell running the Senate, they couldn't get the deal, the sellout to the super rich plutocrats, the Koch brother stratum of society. They couldn't get it, but now they got it thanks to Obama. Obama is worse than Bush in that sense, worse than Bush also in the sense that he's kept more troops in the field than Bush did just about every single day of his presidency. So that's McConnell. Now, we've got the new guy is from AIG, and we've also got the story with Berwick, right? Butcher Berwick, one of the top honchos of the Medicare program, he now says that it's time to reinstate these end-of-life counseling sessions, and much more serious than that even, Avastin has been banned. And again, the reactionaries call attention to this. The reactionaries, of course, are perfectly willing to have you die through the objective triage, the objective cost controls of the market, but they don't like the administrative cost controls. They want it to be done in this so-called anonymous automatic way behind your back. But the story now is, in the Obamacare, we have a death panel. The real death panel is not even the end-of-life care. It's the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAC, Independent Payment Advisory Board. I've talked on the program about the older forms of this, MedPAC and IMAC, but now you got to forget those. I won't repeat them again. It's now IPAC, Independent Payment Advisory Board, and they now say that Avastin, a potent but costly drug for advanced stage breast cancer, does not show a sufficient benefit in slowing disease progression to outweigh the significant risk to patients. Well, what risk? You're fighting for your life. The benefits are insufficient. Well, the thing is, of course, it's outrageously overpriced. It's probably developed with government research, but they want $90,000 a year for Avastin, and that's obviously not cost effective. So they're telling a whole group of sick women that they are going to have to give up their lives to save the bottom line of Medicare, which has now been looted by Obama to the tune of $500 billion. That's the reality of Obama. It is genocide. This is the beginning of genocide against the American people, starting in the typical vile way with sick, helpless, defenseless women. Well, maybe they'll know how to fight back. Maybe somebody will. We don't want the Independent Payment Advisory Board making binding decisions, which are binding. These are unelected, unappointed, unaccountable, pointy-headed bureaucrats, unless Congress can come up with equivalent cost savings in some other form, is what's written into this Obama bill. So remember, Obama was the one who said, well, after my mother had cancer, maybe it was a bad idea to invest in a hip replacement for her. He's told you that you can't eat what you want, you can't have the kind of car you want, you can't have the temperature in your house that you want. Guy's a Malthusian, and again, as Berg says, quicker we dump them, better it is all around. So we'll be back in just a minute here on World Crisis Radio.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Just one last thing on the financial situation. We now have a new category of zombie bank. Beyond the zombie bank, or as a new acute category within the universe of the zombie banks, we have the deadbeat zombie banks. And these are defined as zombie institutions which have received money under the bailout, under the TARP, the Bush, Paulson, Palin, McCain, Obama TARP of October 2008. But that have defaulted on payments. There are now 132 banks that have defaulted on TARP payments, and there are 19 such banks which have missed six or more payments. Now, it'd be interesting. This is a Friday again. This is when Sheila Bair strikes at the little prey. She doesn't go after the big game in Wall Street. She goes after the Community Bank of Podunk Center out in the High Plains or something like this. We're told that they're all community lenders. I don't know. Take a look at that Bank of America stock chart. Take a look at the Citibank stock chart. Take a look at some of the others. They're supposedly solid institutions. They're on the cartel committee. But I'm from Missouri, I guess, when it comes to this. We have had about 155 banks that have been shut down during 2010, all small ones, because otherwise they survive under too big to fail. The illegal policy, the criminal illegal policy pursued by Sheila Bair, darling of the media, is too big to fail. Not public law, but too big to fail. That's her lodestar. And we've also got, 450 banks on the troubled list? So you add that up. Our 1929 to 1931 parallel is, of course, first the break, the panic in New York, then the European banking collapse, and then the U.S. banking panic coming back. So all is in readiness for a banking crisis here in the U.S., which proceeds pari passu, let us say, hand in hand with the further breakdown of European state finances. And again, you could stop this dead in its tracks within 48 hours, ban credit default swaps, ban collateralized debt obligations, 1% emergency Tobin tax on all financial transactions over $1 million per person, and a few other things like that. Re-regulate those commodities markets, stop fraud closures, enforce the antitrust law, shut down zombie banks if they violate the existing regulations, which most of them do. All right. In Russia, a happy note at the end of the year. Khodorkovsky gets six more years in jail. His sentence now goes up to 14 years, 8 years plus six more years based on the latest conviction. And you saw Putin coming out at his year-end question-answering session saying criminals and thieves should be in jail. How refreshing. The richest oligarchical predator in the country is put in jail, even if this is not typical of the policy as a whole. This is a whole lot better than where we are. Imagine the mental liberation that would occur if the arch monopolist and arch exploiter, destroyer of companies and jobs, Bill Gates, were to be jailed, or his pretentious friend Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha. How about if they were to join Khodorkovsky in a Siberian prison camp? Wouldn't that be somehow poetic justice for what these people have done to the American people? And we're also now watching Hillary Clinton in a real lather about this. I'm thinking of Lord Palmerston, right? If you were a British citizen, he would defend you with gunboats anywhere. A Greek got arrested, and he came forward with that famous civis Romanus sum, or civis Romanus sum, depending on your Latin approach. For Clinton, it's oligarchus sum, oligarchus Americanus sum. Anywhere in the world, there's a finance oligarch. They're an implied protected category for the United States. Now, let's look forward to the ogres of this other stripe that are now coming to town. We've got Spencer Bacchus, the Lord of Wine. The disciples of Bacchus are coming to town. Spencer Bacchus is going to become head of the House Financial Services and Banking Committee. And he says, government and the regulators are here to serve the banks. Regulators are here to serve the banks. How refreshing. Joe Barton, I don't know whether he got the House Energy Committee, but he apologizes to BP. for the idea that they're being called to account. It is interesting that the Republicans have dropped the plan to privatize Fannie and Freddie. If you were in a Tea Party fanatic and you believed they would do this, they're not going to do it because that would bring down the entire system. So you're going to get a whole bunch of people. House Foreign Relations goes into the hands of Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, for whom, of course, the world revolves around Cubar and the need to oust Fidel Castro and Raul from there. That's now going to be the main issue in American foreign policy, which I submit is not the case. But let's look at some of these other people. We've got Boehner, of course. We've got Cantor. We've got some of the ones that I've mentioned. But let's take a rank and file one. He's written up in the Washington Post this past week. Here we have Congressman-elect Mike Kelly, Republican from Pennsylvania. I think it's Butler, Pennsylvania, half an hour or so north of Pittsburgh. He is a wealthy Chevrolet dealer in this town with 110 employees. He's the oldest freshman. He's avuncular. That's something you might have learned from Reagan, right? How to be nasty but pretend to be a nice uncle. His motto, kill more than you eat. Kill more than you eat, and when you don't kill, eat less. And when he comes and he sees the toadies at the Congress taking his coat and so forth, he says, I'm thinking somebody has to pay for all these folks to be here, and it's all paid by us. That's U.S. taxpayer money. Well, you get the idea. Cut and gut. And again, repeatedly, run the country like a business. Run the country like a business. And he got into a, I think, a justified rage when Ratner the Rat came after him and tried to take his General Motors dealership away in 2009, Chevrolet and Cadillac, and he'd been his family had been doing this for a long time. But he's now out there in Butler, Pennsylvania. There used to be the AK Steel Factory, which had 3,500 workers, and now it has 1,300. It used to be that the big industry in the town was the Pullman plant to build Pullman cars for the railroad. So he's coming in, and his idea is brutal austerity. And you see the sociology of these people. This is the petty bourgeoisie. This is the middle class of a certain type. In his case, he's an auto dealer. You can see he's kind of an appendage of not even of General Motors, but of General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is now called Ally, in case you're keeping score. Real estate brokers, insurance brokers, stock brokers, auto dealers, people in the petty bourgeoisie who are not the independent petty bourgeoisie of doctors and lawyers of once upon a time, small town newspaper editors, no. They are direct appendages of Wall Street. And here we have people whose mentality tends to gravitate towards the right wing Wall Street faction, the Rupert Murdoch, George Shultz, Koch Brothers faction. And that's what you're going to get. So it's very likely that we will have an Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March. The Ides of March this time around will be the legislation passed funds the government until about March. And at the same time, we're going to be bumping up against the national debt limit. Will there be an attempt to dictate draconian apocalyptic austerity, to starve the beast, to loot and strip and flay the American people under the cover of fiscal responsibility in March, April of this year? And, of course, if it comes, Obama will capitulate right away. So what do we do? That's our problem right now. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio on this last day of the old year. Keep up with my work at topley.net. So we're going to have Republican Tea Party ogres coming to town. There is a possibility for a draconian genocidal austerity convergence with Obama, but it may also be that the ideological rage of these Tea Party types is so overwhelming that they go for some kind of government shutdown and or default bankruptcy by the United States. And again, these people are at war with the Constitution. They're constantly wearing the Constitution on their sleeve. They hate the Constitution. They hate the General Welfare Clause. The General Welfare Clause is in the preamble. The General Welfare Clause is in Section 1, where they talk about the duties of Congress. The General Welfare Clause is in there not once but twice, and they hate it. The Constitution also says that the Congress shall have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. They hate that one. They hate the 14th Amendment. They hate the 16th Amendment. They hate the direct election of senators. There's a whole bunch of amendments that they hate, and they're going to try to roll back some of these. I hope they do, because they'll run up against a brick wall. And it will also show people, once again, the bankruptcy of both parties, not just Obama and the Wall Street Democrats, obviously bankrupt. And we've been fighting them now for 3 years here in the trenches. But we've also now got these reactionary Republicans, Austrians, whatever we want to call them, some kind of foreign body with some obscure foreign ideology which violates the high wage, high technology, high capital intensity tradition of the United States. Let's look back. Of course, Alfred Kahn died this week. Alfred alias Genghis Kahn. Normally, de mortuis nihil nisi bonum, but unfortunately, this is an important case. Alfred Kahn was a New York City investment banker, scion, professor of economics at Cornell. This is where deregulation started. Look at the obituaries of Alfred Kahn, and you will see that he began the deregulation of airlines, which has driven how many out of business? And you think, you look at the wasteland of commercial aviation today. Can you really say that this was well done? Look at trucking. Look at electricity. Look at the opening the door to Enron. Look at the deregulation of derivatives. The whole Austrian deregulation furor has qualitatively debased and destroyed and degraded the U.S. economy. And now they want more. Remember, in the Schultz plan, George Schultz and that faction want tax cuts for the rich, cut domestic discretionary spending, mainly unemployment benefits, gouge, cut, and destroy entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, deregulate everything and have a strong dollar, deflate the dollar, and use that to increase the power of these super rich. So Alfred Kahn departs from the scene. But now let's look in the case of Florida. We have got this guy, Rick Scott, who now, this is now competition for Chris Christie. You know Chris Christie, the Garden State Göring. Chris Christie is a little bit under a cloud this week because his performance in the New Jersey blizzard of the day after Christmas was wretched. He was out in Disneyland cavorting with his kids, and this did not sit well with the working people there in Trenton and elsewhere. So Christie not looking too good as a result of his malfeasance during the strike during the blizzard. But now we have competition, right? Who is the most reactionary Republican governor? Rick Scott. Now, what's his background? Hospital Corporation of America, and you know their business model. It's now called Columbia HCA. Their model was to pick four nonprofit community hospitals and to essentially find ways to drive them into bankruptcy so that they could be privatized as for-profit HCA hospitals. And that's those are the methods that Scott wants to bring to Florida. And we have an interesting op-ed here, today's Wall Street Journal, Friday, December 31st, by Steve Moore. You see him on TV all the time. He's a friend of Kudlow and any number of others. So he's on here, Rick Scott, saying, I'm going to run this state like a business. What does that mean? Well, he wants to phase out the state corporation income tax, slash property taxes, That means the education system is going to be gutted. Rapidly expand the state's K-12 vouchers and charter schools so Florida parents have more education options. In other words, so rich oligarchs get a huge discount on the expensive private schools that they can afford for their kids. Now, Scott, unfortunately, is also under a cloud because his company there was a party to $1.6 billion, with a B, in fraudulent Medicare and Medicaid claims in the mid-1990s by Columbia Hospital Corporation, which was Mr. Scott's firm at the time. So how is he going to say, I'm going to reform Medicaid in the state, when his track record is that he is a party to these, or at least he's presiding over these $1.6 billion in fraudulent claims? And unfortunately, the Democrat in that race was unable to bring home this issue. Obviously, the Democrats, because of their own subservience to the oligarchical financiers, they can't fight this stuff. The most interesting thing now about Rick Scott is forced labor. Forced labor, and by that I mean Zwangsarbeit. Zwangsarbeit in the, what can we say, National Socialist tradition. He says if you're unemployed after 13 weeks, you're going to be put to work. You're going to be getting forced labor in Florida, and they're going to make you do things. Now, they say community service. I don't think it's going to be community service. I think his idea will be, we'll put you to work as a scab. We'll put you to work as a strike breaker, as a replacement worker, as they like to say. We'll go someplace where there's a strike of hotel employees or janitors or other low-wage, low-skilled workers, and we'll force unemployment recipients to become the reserve army of the unemployed, right, the potential pool of scabs and strike breakers, except this time not organized even so much by the bosses, but organized by the government of Florida under the control of Rick Scott. So if you were planning to take refuge in Florida, you better think again. He, of course, wants the entire Medicaid program to be completely farmed out to the states. The answer to that is, remember that the reason that oligarchs prefer states' rights is because it's easier for oligarchs to dominate a state than it is to dominate the federal government. The proof of that is also, if you look at this past election, the 65 Republican gains, you notice that there's a disparity between the Senate and the House. The degree of Republican prevalence in the House is much larger. What explains this? It's the same election, same conditions, same kinds of candidates in many cases. The difference is that in the smaller unit, the congressional district of 500,000 or 600,000 people, the money coming in from foreigners, from the Koch brothers, from other plutocrats, can be much more effective. That's where the money can buy an election. Harder to do that in a state because there are other competing interests. There are some unions. There are some other things that may not be present in a narrowly defined congressional district in the suburbs. But in a state, it's likely to be a more of a cross-section of the population. So, again, the smaller the unit, the more oligarchical dominance you're going to have. That's feudalism. That's what neo-feudalism is all about. So we're left now at the end of the year. Obama's a Wall Street puppet. He's a warmonger. He's a union buster. He's a totalitarian. He has this Napolitano running around. He's going to impose the carbon dictatorship with the EPA, or he's going to try. He can't fight the Republicans. He's going to capitulate on these points. He's already said he wants to start cutting the budget in 2011. Well, what have we found in Europe? The Europeans have found what Brüning taught us already between 1930 and 1932. The more you cut a budget in a depression, the bigger the deficit will be in the out year, that is to say in successive budget years. So it's time to get together and have a candidate to challenge Obama in those primaries, because that entire phenomenon begins next week, next month. January 2011, the presidential candidates get going, and we hope it's not going to be Haley Barbour and not going to be other reactionaries, odious types that we see running around. So we've got to wish all of our listeners a very happy, healthy, prosperous new year. The best to all of you. And remember, stay tuned to Topley.net. And if you've still got some holiday shopping, buy some of those books that are offered there. And there will be some more coming in 2011. But we'll see you next year.